We end up with this 28-year-old lovely girl, and she has asthma. And I ask her, how does it feel like? And she says, I feel alone. I have no friends. I was teased in school. It was horrible. I said, so what do you do about it? She said, I have a secret. And she went down in her bag and she pulled out a straw. And she said, I give this straw to all my friends and ask them to breathe through the straw while holding themselves for the nose. And then they get it and they create sort of a sense of empathy with me and we're friends. And I stole that idea. And I asked senior management to breathe through a straw. And after 30 seconds, everyone in management spit out the straw. They said, why are you doing this? It's ridiculous. I said, because this is how your patients feel every minute of their entire life.
Welcome to Elevate, a podcast about achievement, personal growth, and pushing limits in leadership and life. I'm Robert Glaser, and I chat with world-class performers who have committed to elevating their own life, pushing the limits of their capacity, and helping others to do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Jeff Weiner. You have to maintain a culture of transformation and stay true to your values. Our guest today, Martin Lindstrom, has driven transformation in many organizations and brands. He's the founder and chairman of the Lindstrom Company, the world's leading brand and culture transformation group. He's also the author of 7 New York Times best-selling books, was named one of Time's 100 most influential people, and has been named as one of Thinkers 50's top business thinkers for 3 years running. And his newest book just released is The Ministry of Common Sense, How to Eliminate Bureaucratic Red Tape, Bad Excuses, and Corporate Bullshit. Martin, welcome. It's great to have you on the Elevate Podcast.
Thank you. And I love the fact that you are not saying BS, but bullshit, because I've had a fight with my publisher about that for a year. Okay.
Well, I love the title. And I realize now might be can't listen in some countries or genres, but I'm going to read it as it is. That's low on the swear list. So,
yeah, it is. Well, listen, good to be on your show. I know, as you know, I'm a huge fan of your work, and there's so much in common with what we're doing, right? So it's, you know, it's just amazing that you and I are connecting.
Yeah. This is an interesting time for organizations where they have to transform, and we'll get into that, whether they want a choice. But so you are incredibly creative. I'm always interested in hearing, particularly for people creative, what was sort of early life for you? Give us a picture of teenage, first job. What were you doing back then?
Well, when I was 12 years of age, I loved Lego. And I mean, when I'm saying Lego, I was serious about this. It took me a year to develop my own Legoland in the backyard of my mom and dad's garden. So I opened up this Legoland and only 2 people showed up, my mom and my dad, which really was the lowest point of my career, right? So here we go. I went to the local print office and I persuaded them to put an ad in the paper. And guess what? 2 days later, I had 131 visitors showing up at my Legoland. There's just one problem. Visitor number 130 and visitor number 131 were the lawyers from Lego suing me. And I said, it's my brand. And they said, no, it's ours. Now, here's the good news. The owner of Lego heard about it and it literally traveled to my parents' house. I mean, this is like Willy Wonka the Chocolate Factory story, right?
This is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And he said to me, hey, I want to offer you a job at Lego. So I was the youngest kid in history getting a job at Lego at the age of 12. And that was really where I began my career. Later on, I opened up an advertising agency a couple of years later, had Lego as a client, sold it to BBDO when I was 18. And then off I went into the world of creativity.
Sweet. What did you sell when you were 18? The agency?
My advertising agency, yeah.
You sold wow.
I had an agency when I was 13 and I sold it when I was 18 to BBDO, yeah.
All right. So I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to guess you were not paying attention in school.
What?
or filling in the bubbles as required.
No, not at all. I don't have an education, really. My education has been life. And, you know, it began even earlier because my parents took me out of school when I was 8 years of age. And we traveled around the world for 2 years on a boat. And I was given one mission, that was to earn money so we could afford food on the table. So I literally would go up in each port and sell small Lego men, and I would earn money, and then I could pay for our food. And I did that for 2 years. So my dad, he was saying, he was teaching me about life. That was my mission, he said. And my mom was teaching him about learning about manners. And right. that's my 2 points in my bag, right?
Well, I was saying before, if you had had social media for your little Lego land, it would have been a totally different story. You would have been viral. You would have been the Lego kid and would have been all over, right?
Yeah, yeah, it would have been very different. But, you know, you also know me that I have a really ambivalent relationship to social media. I mean, I was the first to bring Lego online in 1994 when the World Wide Web was invented, and I started up a huge internet company back then. But also 3 years ago, I skipped my phone. And I skip my phone because I do feel it kills creativity right now. It kills interaction and being present. So yes, I probably would have been addicted to it back then because I didn't have the perspective I have today.
You know, this creativity thing is interesting. And I said the joke about school. We haven't talked about this before. I just know based on the type that particularly kids that are very creative and entrepreneurial, the school environment does not service them. And my daughter right now is applying to college and, you know, she's studying for the ACT and the SAT, and it's about getting the right answers in the bubble, right? This is hundreds of hours to do this, to get in university. And I was thinking, like, my whole job is, most of what I do is figuring out answers to problems that are nonlinear. There is no right answer. And it's just such a disconnect with, I think, what's going on today. I understand that some industries and professions are about getting it right, you know, cutting in the right place or otherwise. But it seems like we're disservicing a huge group of kids who just, that's not what they are and who they're going to be. And the system doesn't work for them. So do you have any ideas on how to encourage that, but not stifle it? It sounds like your parents had an idea, but we don't see that really scalable in the education system.
I think there's two things to have in mind. The first thing is you need to have role models. And I'm not sure who role models are today in the life of a young person, because role models very quickly can become a cliche. One of these YouTubers, and when I ask around in our research, asking kids what they want to be, I mean, 50% will say a YouTuber. Now, for me, it's probably not the most ideal role model. The second thing is I do think that if I was operating in the school sector, I would employ really good psychologists whom were armed with tools to find out where the true interest and true skills are among young kids. And that's not necessarily your grades in school, but perhaps how good are you with people? How good are you with empathy? How good are you at telling stories? How good are you engaging with others? And then based on that, try to map up a career plan or path for these kids. Not one of those where you have to go to jail, meaning every right. minute is sort of mapped out for you the rest of the world, but to give you a dot on the wall you can navigate towards. And I do think I meet a lot of people when they're 25 years of age and they still don't know what they want to do and they're really confused about it. I guess my benefit for all this was I knew exactly that I wanted to work in advertising when I was 9. I'm not kidding. And I've always had that goal. And then later on, it became branding, and then it became culture and innovation. But really, it was the same path in the end of the day. That's a reason why I would claim that Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours kind of was true for me. But all these poor kids not knowing what they want to do because it's so late in the process. And well, I would change it by having these experts dealing with them at a very young age and guiding them as mentors.
Yeah, and the problem is for one kid, what they need to do is figure out how to get the answers right. And the other kid needs to just be creative or do something for which there is no right answer. And that's just not going to fit in the box. So,
well, that's because you have a linear education system, as you're pointing out. And right. it's also because you do assume it's one size fit all. I would have two classes. I would have the creative class because we know from all sorts of experiments that if you are creative, you are stimulated by other creatives. But we also know that if you're not encouraged to be creative, your creativity dies. And the same with the linear folks, exactly the same. So yes, you have to split it. But you know what? I think that's a dream scenario in a world now where we can't even run one class. two classes.
Now you can be creative. You're at home. You know, you can do whatever you want to do.
You can. You can.
All right. So you started the Lindstrom Company about the beginning of 2000. And I think you, one of the really focused on personal and business branding. You were sort of predicting explosion in the focus on branding. What tipped you off to that change, or that was going to become important?
I think in the beginning, what I've always realized, this is a funny story. With my mom, she actually had a cosmetic chain, and she would have a clinic where she would give facials and whatever to her patients. And I would be lying on the floor. Now, I'm 6 and 7 years of age back then. And then I would listen to what these customers would be saying while she was in the room. And then they would leave, they would say something completely different. And I was very puzzled about it. So I started to do surveys and ask them and realized whatever I did, it would be different answers. And so I've always had in mind that what people are telling you is not necessarily what they're thinking and feeling. So later on in the game, I began combining branding with, you know, new things. So first, back in the days, I would take clicks and mortar, and I invented that term to say online and offline. And then I would write a book about the senses called Brand Sense, where I, you know, basically infused the senses into how we build brands. And as a result of that, you know, and so what I've always done is to combine two ordinary things in a new way. And when it comes to neuroscience, what I learned was, guess what? 85% of what we do every day is subconscious. So that's what's fascinating me. I want to understand why I am doing what I'm doing. And I've evolved that ever since. All of it comes around to a very simple premise, that is that we are all about people. And if you appeal to people and motivate people the right way, whether that's customers and employees, you know, you get a lot more out of it. It's more fun and it's more productive. And in the end of the day, that's what I'm doing. So branding has helped me to understand perception and then to understand culture.
Is it about making the subconscious more conscious? Is that a big part of it?
No, it's a matter, well, yes and no. It's a matter about being aware of the subconscious so that when you do irrational things, you know why. I mean, here's the issue. If I ask most people about how irrational they are, I think 9 out of 10 will say I'm deeply rational, right? Yet, I'm not sure if you're like me, if I grab a remote control and it's flat for batteries, you press even harder to squeeze the last drop of battery out of it, right? And so that's deeply irrational. We knock on wood. We do all that stuff. We fall in love. But we don't want to recognize that side of our story. It's like, oh no, it's embarrassing. I'm irrational. No, it's 85% of your life. And because of that, what I try to do is to understand the irrational side, whether that is to travel around the world and move in with people in their homes, and I've done that nearly 3,000 times over the last 2 decades, or it is to scan.
Wait, you moved into people's homes 3,000 times?
Yeah, it's true.
This sounds like a way to not have to pay rent.
Well, yeah, and to pay a lot for airline tickets, right? Yeah. It was crazy.
So that was on behalf of clients?
Yeah, in most cases it was. It really happened when Nestle back in the days, they said to me, hey, we want you to reinvent infant formula. So I started to move in and spend time with young mothers to understand their lives in China. And then later on expanded, a lot of brands said to me, what's going on? I mean, Lego is a very good example. Back in the days, Lego had a huge crisis. It's about 15 years ago and was actually close to bankruptcy. And the reason why was because they listened to big data, and big data was all about correlation. And big data was concluding that the instant gratification generation had arrived. You know, kids had no patience whatsoever to play with Legos. So Lego changed the size of the bricks from these tiny bricks to gigantic building blocks, right? And sales dropped 31% that year. So what they did was they moved in with kids across the world. And this is a true story. In one of the stories, they went into a home of an 11-year-old boy, and we asked him one question: what are you most proud of? And this kid, he points at a shelf where there's an old worn-down pair of sneakers. And of course, the Lego team is completely perplexed. Why would he say that? Because they expected Nintendo or PlayStation or whatever. So they asked him why. He said, because I'm the best skater in town. You see, if you skate down a skateboard, it creates a certain wear and tear on the side of that sole. And exactly that angle is the indicator of he was number one. And that was the time where the Lego had a eureka moment, because they realized it's not the size doing it for the Lego bricks. It was actually the ability to infuse storytelling into things. Because if a kid is willing to spend hundreds, not thousands of hours fine-tuning an ankle on a shoe, why wouldn't they play with Lego for thousands of hours? So out of that, the Lego movie was invented. And out of that, Lego became not only the number one toy company in the world, but seven times bigger brand value-wise than number two. And this came out of moving in consumer homes and understand the psychology from a consumer point of view rather than assuming things and reading spreadsheets.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So I worked for a brilliant inventor who had over 100 patents about 10 or 12 years ago on some projects, and he's since passed away, but he invented actually automatic flushing toilets. And one of the things that I've learned from him was, you know, I talked to all these other companies and they were, oh, we're working on this top secret confidential, you know, thing. And he would have me do some research and it would go to the customer and say, if the product can, he said, look, I know how to do it. No one else has to do it. If the product can do this, would you buy it? What would you pay? I always found that these top secret companies who weren't talking to customers, it just seemed like he was trying to invent a cylindrical digital printer. So it actually print, look, just saying that doesn't mean you know how to do it. This is 12 years ago. But, you know, if you talk to the client, they said, oh, if you delivered that product at this price point, I would buy 1,000 of them. And it taught me a huge lesson that exactly you say, how many people are sitting there, you know, in it with spreadsheets and reports and whatever, and not talking to their current and prospective customers.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? 2 years ago, I bought a dual suspension mountain bike for the first time. And it pushed me to ride trails that I had never been willing to try before. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has exceptional capability that will have you seeing the possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. The Lexus GX comes with available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, best-in-class towing capacity, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. I've seen the new Lexus GX popping up all around my town, and not only does it have the capabilities to take you to new places on and off the road, but it's a great-looking car. The new Lexus GX is ready to raise the bar for you. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hey, Elevate listeners. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify is the partner you need to keep the cash register ringing for your e-commerce business. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading platforms. I advise a lot of companies in the e-commerce space, and almost all of them have migrated to Shopify. And as a buyer, what I love about buying from Shopify-enabled sites is that they already know who I am, and I don't have to create a new account or enter all my payment info. The Shop Pay service makes it faster and easier to buy, which surely helps with conversions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/elevate, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/elevate now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/elevate.
Brings me back to one of the focus points I have today, because what I've realized is that companies have lost common sense. They are seeing the world from inside out. And because of that, they're more focused on protecting what they have, compliance, regulations, rules, and guidelines. But it's when you turn the table and you see the world from outside in, you start to realize this. And let me give you an example of what's really telling. One of our clients is one of the largest pharma clients in the world. They're the number one player in respiratory field, you know, asthma and all that stuff. And I remember I spoke to them about a year ago and asked them, how often have you spent time with your patients? And they said, never. I said, never. For 100 years, never. Yeah, that's true. We can't do it because of compliance. I said, BS. So I spoke to compliance, persuaded them to go into patients' homes, and we end up with this 28-year-old lovely girl, and she has asthma. And I ask her, how does it feel like? And she says, I feel alone. I have no friends. I was teased in school. It was horrible. I said, so what do you do about it? She said, I have a secret. And she went down in her bag and she pulled out a straw. And she said, I give this straw to all my friends and ask them to breathe through the straw while holding themselves for the nose. And then they get it and they create sort of a sense of empathy with me and we're friends. And I stole that idea. And I asked senior management to breathe through a straw. And after 30 seconds, everyone in management spit out the straw. They said, why are you doing this? It's ridiculous. I said, because this is how your patients feel every minute of their entire life. And what happened was really remarkable because suddenly it was like you had a magic wand. They suddenly had a sense of empathy inside the organization. And suddenly R&D was developing products seen from a patient's point of view. HR was employing people with empathy. And what I learned from that exercise was, and this is what's so fascinating, there's a direct correlation between empathy and common sense. The more you have common sense, the more you actually have a degree of empathy. And guess what? In our life today, empathy is almost disappearing. You know, our study shows today that empathy levels are down 50% over the last decade because of Botox, which is removing facial movements, because of triggers, because of social media, because of our session of that little photo on the corner, because of KPIs and silos and all that stuff. And that's killing that common sense, which typically made a startup become successful and later on made it fail.
Yeah, that's interesting. There was some study I read where they were showing teenagers like posters of facial expressions, right? And they just couldn't identify them because of all the online interaction. And so again, how do you empathize if you don't know whether someone's sad, mad, glad, frustrated, sarcastic, right? It's interesting. So yeah, I mean, you're getting there into your book. I'll tie it into the next question, Ministry of Common Sense. So look, you are hired to help organizations transform, become creative, do something that they weren't doing. So I'm guessing this runs into a lot of bureaucratic red tape, bad excuses, and corporate bullshit. So, that was a great example, but what are some of the principles from the book, or how does an organization or a person, you know, move away from this is how we've always done it mentality, which actually stopped work? You know, people didn't have a choice to, if you're a gym and this is how you've always done it and you're shut down, you were forced to figure out in 2020 a new model of doing that. But what has made the difference for you in terms of getting by that red tape and being able to really drive transformation in some of your clients?
Let me put this into perspective. There was an experiment done with chickens. They're put into a cage, stuck there for half a year. And one day they're let out on the beautiful green grass and the sun was shining and the birds were singing. And guess what? The chickens went out. And after 30 seconds, they went straight back in again.
Yeah.
And I call that the chicken cage syndrome. And really it's the fear of the unknown. So when you want to change organizations, you have to be aware of that organizations have what I call an immune system. It's a defense mechanism for change. It's kind of a straitjacket which is holding you back from change. So how do you get the chickens out? There's two things you can do. If I was to do a drawing right now, and you imagine you have four chicken cages seen from top, and if they are pointing towards a square, all of these, if I place the corn in the middle of that square, most chickens will probably say, oh, that's very far away. It's really risky. My KPIs are not allowed around that. What if this manager is being fired? I'll look like a fool. So you look to the other ones and they'll look around, they'll look at each other and they'll go back in again. Yeah. And that is the biggest mistake. If you want to do transformations in organizations, you can't do it with a long-term sort of action plan. You have to create what I call a 90-day intervention. Small, bite-sized celebrations which are reemphasizing your behavioral change. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is, the issue and the reason why companies are so stupid quite often is because they become addicted to their own Kool-Aid. They're seeing the world from one point of view and it becomes self-enforcing in the message. So you have to force them out of that perspective. And here's what I did for a client. So we have a client called Maersk. Maersk is the largest shipping
containers, yeah.
Exactly, you're good, yeah. 21% of all trade in the world is Maersk.
Wasn't that the line, the captain on the boat? Wasn't that Maersk?
It was, yeah. Tom Hanks, yeah. They invented the container ship, right? It's crazy, right? So been around for 100 years. You know my formula. Big company, 100 years, lots of different layers, a lot of bureaucracy, no common sense called nonsense. Right? That's sort of the hierarchy here. Yeah. So anyway, they knock on my door. They say, hey, we really have a problem. How do we fix this? And I sort of started to spend time with captains on the ships. I spent time with the customers in Japan, in India, in Turkey, wherever. And I realized there's a term in that industry called rolling. Now, I'm sure you had never even heard about the term. I had no idea about rolling. Rolling means if you're shipping your container, if someone else is paying a higher fee to have their container shipped, it will override your container and it will be stocked in the port for a day more, a week more, a month more. Doesn't really matter.
So this is like Google search for containers, basically.
It is, right? Yeah. Except that you don't really know about it and you will never find out, except if you're sending flowers from Colombia, they're really not flowers anymore when they arrive, right? Yeah. So that's called rolling. It's an industry standard. So I said to them, you must be kidding. And the people at Maersk said to me, yeah, but we are 5% better than everyone else. I said, well, that's not the point. You just can't do this. So I could not convince them. So I did an exercise. This is important. I said to them, imagine Maersk buys Uber. Now, I took Uber because they spied Uber. It's not part of their industry. It's outside. So not Uber buying Maersk, but Maersk buying Uber. What would happen? And then we had 88,000 people around the world brainstorming on the consequences. And suddenly, just like that straw, they got it. My gosh, it means that people will be kicked out of this car halfway through one more time. Sorry, that type of thing. And we created an animated movie, so we had to send it around. And suddenly I created a sense of empathy. And once that happened, then we could turn around the organization. And what was fascinating about this is within 2 years, we tripled the NPS. And the share price has tripled over the last year alone because empathy is part of the DNA. And this is my message. So what I would do if you had to work on this is to find the friction point seen from a customer's point of view, attach a 90-day intervention around it, turn it upside down and see it through the consumer's point of view, but see it through a irrational point of view. Assume that consumers and customers are not rational, but irrational, and then fix it by applying a solution. Celebrate it after 90 days and then repeat that cycle, right?
Can you explain the rational? So if you're assuming they're irrational, does that mean they won't do what is right for them? Or explain that part to me.
Well, let me give you an example. So if we go up in the air, so I'll take another client of ours, which is Swiss International Airlines. When we were asked to fix the airline on economy class, normally,
and what was wrong with it when?
Well, there's two things which
everything.
Were wrong. Well, not really, not compared to American airline, but compared to European, there was.
That's my American view. It's a tough business to be in.
It is tough. So, yeah, well, first of all, they're not on time. It's Swiss and they're not on time. That's kind of ironic.
That is ironic.
Yeah. And it was kind of people are not happy. So, if I would have said to them, hey, what's the issue? Well, let's fix the legroom, the catering food, the entertainment system, I'm sure I would have been fired. And we had to increase the prices anyway with 30%.
Yeah.
So what we did was we spent time with passengers and I took the captains with me. I took the cabin crew. I took the Lockett's carousel managers with me into homes of passengers around the world where we were packing the suitcase. We're traveling with them. Mm. And there was one word coming up all the time, one word, and that was anxiety. Anxiety of, will I reach this plane? Will I get COVID? Will I this and that? So then we went back and understood, tried to understand what is anxiety. Remember, anxiety is deeply irrational, right? I don't need to tell you, right?
Yeah.
So what we did here was we said, why don't we remove that systematically? So what we did was I said, time and anxiety is very linked. So I teamed up with the captains and I said, hey, why don't we install a new piece of software in the cockpit where we can see the conditions on ground? And we did that. So this is a true announcement. Welcome on board on Swiss International Airlines. We're about 40 minutes away from JFK Kennedy's airport. And I have some good news. I've just been in contact with ground handling, which are informing me that we will arrive at gate 107. Which is good news because it's only a 7-minute walk from immigration. And even better, immigration is informing me that the waiting time is 11 minutes. And Lockets Carousel managers are telling me that there's only a 14-minute wait for your lockets. So with a bit of luck, you will be out of the system in around 30 minutes. Even better, I've been on Waze and I can see that the transportation time to Manhattan is only 48 minutes. So again, if we're lucky, you'll be back home in your home in around 2 hours from now on. I hope you enjoyed flying with Swiss International Airlines.
And that whole speech works as long as you're not an hour late.
No, yeah, no, yeah. That's not true.
Really?
Because this is what's so interesting. Let's say you're an hour late. Then you're saying to them, ladies and gentlemen, I've just been informed that we are late. In fact, we are on time up here in the cloud, but there's problems at immigration right now. In fact, the waiting time down there is 46 minutes at the moment. So it doesn't matter if you get on ground fast or late, because in fact, you will go through this condition. But what I can inform you about, with the current situation, you will be back home in around 3 hours from now on. By saying that, by informing the passengers up front, you basically keep your image of being on time because you are the one informing rather than the other one, which is, folks, this is captain on board on American Airlines. We are a couple of more minutes late. And then you wait for another 5 hours, right? You're standing on the time mark, just waiting and waiting and waiting, right?
Right.
I mean, you have to be transparent in the information. So anxiety for me is number
unknown,
one. Right. It's unknown. Yeah. And that is what's driving the subconscious, the irrational, the 85%, right?
So how did you measure? Well, first of all, there's a similar, one of our better airlines is Southwest.
Yeah.
And, you know, they really focus on the pilots just connecting. Absolutely. And some humor, and they come out. And I remember we landed early when I was flying, I think, from Boston to Baltimore before COVID. And I remember, this is something I remember the pilot said a year and a half later. You don't remember this. And he said, look, ladies and gentlemen, we're in about 22 minutes early today. So just remember, you owe us next time we're late. And, you know, it was just some great levity. And again, how many times do you remember the line that a pilot said, you know, 2 years ago, creating some connection. So how do they measure the impact of those changes?
Well, we measured it in two different ways. And the first way was in passenger satisfaction, and that went through the roof. But the other one was really ironic. We actually started to become on time again. Huh. Not just because the culture started to, it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, if the captain is saying that, everyone is starting to be aligned around being on time. But there was another little detail I'll tell you about this, Robert. I think you'll like it. So I sneaked on board on the plane after the cabin crew had left the planes, along with the cleaning staff. And I was sitting at one of these rows, and the cleaning staff would arrive, they would lift the armrest, they would vacuum clean the seat, take them down again, and do that throughout the plane. I said to one of my colleagues, do you want to do an experiment with me? Why don't you try to crawl into the window seat and measure how long time will it take? So he did that, 6 seconds. Then I said, let's do the same now, keeping the armrest up. And guess what we learned? He saved 6 seconds. Per row, which is 6 minutes for a plane, which is 6 minutes quicker turnaround, which means 6 minutes on time, which means happy passenger. So we actually jumped from being, I think, number six to number four in a year just because of that insight.
So you asked everyone when you landed just to lift up the armrest?
No, I just asked the cleaning staff not to take it down.
No, I'm saying the policy was the policy. How did you get them all up?
Well, we just talked to the cleaning staff. And the cleaning staff will have to lift it in a way. I just asked them not to take it down. So they will kick it up, and our passengers will take it down when they came in, right? I think my message here is that common sense for me and the Ministry of Common Sense has two things in mind. One is you have to infuse common sense into your organization by seeing it from outside in. And you have to do that by feeling like you are a passenger or a consumer, a patient or a customer. And the second thing is, this is so important, you always have to earn money or save money by doing it. And the reason why is, if it's only helping the passenger or the customers, in today's world, the companies is not motivated by it as much as they would in the past, because it's not linked to the bottom line. But if I can, in parallel with that, link it with the bottom line, then what happens is it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and suddenly it reinforces itself. And actually, the focus comes back on the patient or the passenger or the customers, right?
Right. I mean, it's the win-win you're looking for, right?
With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Let me give you an example on it, just to tell you how crazy this is. Because what I'm talking a lot about is empathy, because it's so linked with common sense. And we all believe we have common sense, and actually very few of us have it because it's dropping as much as it is. But let me give you an example. So Toyota, the car company, reached out to me many years ago, and they said, hey, we want to support the environment. They came up with a hybrid car. We want to support the environment, and we also want to save money. So I suggested they should run a competition across Japan, having all the engineers submit ideas for how to do that. And there was thousands of ideas coming in. And guess what? Not a single one of these ideas could be used. They were complicated, and they were just complex in all sorts of different ways. Now, this is funny. So a 9-year-old kid is on a tour, okay? He walks through the plants with his school, and his dad works in there, and he's very proud. And he hears about the competition. So he's submitting a simple idea, and his idea is, why don't you just shut down all light in all the factory plants? And a little bit like the Empire's New Clothes, you're familiar with the fairy tale, right? Yeah. The little kid saying, yes, no clothes on. Well, in this case, he said, shut down the light. And everyone was saying, what a ridiculous kid. And then literally was saying that, except that he was right, because there's only robots operating in those plants. So there's no people. So why should you have light on, right? Yeah. So they literally shut down the light, saved millions of dollars, saved the environment, and saved money.
So funny. They beat all the engineers.
Mm, yeah, they do. And this is the point. I think the point is, when you're too close to the forest, you can't see it for just trees. I know it's a cliche, but I do think that the more we are stuck behind these screens, and you and I talked about how we hate sitting in front of Zoom all the time, yeah, but the more linear we become, the more we see the world from my point of view, and even worse, I'm sitting looking right now at my little stamp-sized photo of myself.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm getting wrinkles there. Well, that's the reason why the number of plastic surgeries are going up 300%. We are so obsessed about ourselves. That means I'm not taking other point of view into account. It's a self-fulfilling bubble I'm operating in. So more than ever, common sense really need to be restored, because if we don't do that, if we go back to work now and replicate all the mistakes, we didn't get the message of COVID-19. I tend to say, go forward to work and reinvent the wheel now, because this is a moment for you to restore common sense.
But well, to do that, you have to get people listening to each other. And I don't know about the rest of the world, but in the US, you got a lot of people screaming at each other, but I'm not sure they're listening to each other. Like, how do we get people open to the ideas, listening to perspective, not assuming, you know, not drawing a line before they start and having that be their position on something, because then there's no way that this stuff has a chance of success.
It's a very big issue, and you're raising a political issue right now, which is probably the biggest, I think, biggest issue United States have had in recent memory. And I don't need to tell you, the main reason why this is happening is because of social media. No, as much as a lot of people are loving it, it's also a self enforcing media where you build up your own bubble and you see only yourself and your own voice. The less you are exposed for other voices, the more you are willing to align yourself with other voices, because I'm always right. So why should I? It's like a lonely child, right? Why should I care about others? If I have other siblings, I'm used to negotiating and accommodating and aligning myself. So I do think it starts there among others. And it starts with the algorithms. It starts with making sure that there's always a constant dose of other views present in whatever feed you're receiving. That's a good way of starting this process. Can you do it overnight? No, but I have to tell you that I'll give an example for one of the largest food companies in the world. I traveled with the CEO. We went into to homes of consumers. We ended up in Japan. And this CEO, and I mean, this is one of the top food companies in the world. They have more than 200,000 staff employed. They conducted this huge study, 19,000 consumers being interviewed about all sorts of stuff. And then we went into this home of a lady, and we observed her. We spent time with her for about a day. And after that, we got a brilliant idea. And the idea was really turning around this entire company. And I'll never forget it. The CEO went back to the board, and the board said to him, "So what happened with those 19,000 people?" And he literally took the report. I was there, threw it into the bin. And he said, "I felt something, and that's what has to drive us, because we need to reinforce empathy in our organization." And this is my message. My message is, we rarely feel things. We look at things, we don't relate to it anymore because we have no relationship with things. So we need to reinfuse empathy into the way social media is designed. So I would start in Silicon Valley. Of course, we have issues with politicians, but politicians, remember, are kind of mirroring what the population wants. And population is mirroring what they see and what they feel and hear. And that comes back to social media, which today is by far the number one source of information. So I would start at the source.
Or disinformation.
Not disinformation, whatever it is, because it depends on what side you're seeing it at, right? And that's back to empathy, right?
Well, there are opinions, but then, you know, the velocity of which things get shared that are just not checked, right? Or not verified is, that's what's different than what the news, you know, the news has liability, you know, social media does not have liability. So
no, it doesn't. It's a super good point you're saying here. But I also have to be frank with you. I do think the system is broken now, and you cannot repair this, that very big problem you're alluding to. You cannot repair that in a year, because what I would do, and I know some classes now are doing it across the U.S., certainly North Carolina and South Carolina is happening right now, and at Chapel Hill, actually, but in particular at school levels, where kids literally are asked to identify two different points of views on the same topic in the news and try to dissect it and tell the teachers what indicates this is the right piece of news and this is the wrong piece of news.
That's great, yeah.
And going through source recognition. Now, you and I never learned about that in school. We kind of assumed that the media was somewhat objective, right? When we were young. Now, in the meantime, everything has flipped upside down. So for a generation assuming that everything is right and suddenly it's actually not, I do understand why they and I, you know, sometimes have doubts about seeing what's fake and what's not. But the next generation have to learn this from childhood, really. And I don't need to tell you, there's a lag of 10 years to get to that point.
Yeah.
So you better get the school system in order, because if you don't do that, democracy also collapses, in my opinion.
Yeah, and we have to stop calling opinions that we don't agree with fake, right? I mean, this has been applied to, you can have difference of opinions. You can have different, look, anyone who's good at statistics, there are different ways of looking at the same facts.
Yes,
but
please,
just calling things we don't agree with fake is, both sides, is super problematic.
Well, it's a good point. And I think, you know, Bill Birnbach, which is the founder of BBDO and DDB, he had always a little note in his pocket, and it had four words on it. And whenever he would have a conflict with a person or have an argument that could not convince the other person, or something was wrong, he would grab for that little note in his pocket and it would say, "What if he was right?"
Yeah, that's awesome.
And that is the starting point. I don't think we even take the time to grab our pocket anymore.
Yeah. Look, if you want to be, I was having this discussion with someone in a totally different context saying, if you're a marketer, let's say you're a political operative or something, and you want to understand why people resonate with that argument, rather than dismissing it, you would want to deeply understand it, right? And understand why people believed it or otherwise, because that's, if you wanted to even compete against it, you're better off understanding that. It's sort of like the moving into the house, you know, to understand it.
It's exactly the same. And listen, I'm going to give you a really grotesque story, but I think it illustrates the point. I was kidnapped when I was in Venezuela some time ago. And I don't need to tell you, being kidnapped is not a pleasant thing you can experience in your life. But what I learned from that exercise was that I was sitting in this household. You had these people with machine guns sitting next to me and holding me there in that room for a couple of weeks. And I started to ask them about their lives because I'm fundamentally curious. I want to understand about people. I want to understand why do they want to kidnap me beside the obvious. And I learned about their families. I learned about the pain. And listen, I actually had sympathy for them. I actually had empathy for them. I was at that level where I said, do you know what? I really understand where you come from. And they could feel it. And I think for the first time ever, they just let me go. And I later on have been in contact with one of them. And I wrote to him. I said, so why did you let me go? And he said, do you know what? I could feel you understood me. And that was enough. No one has ever listened to me before.
Right. And we don't have to agree, but listening and understanding is...
Yeah, super important.
So there's one thing I wanted to make sure I asked you, because I'm fascinated by this. It's something you've talked about, how each of us has a twin self, and we have an inner age versus a physical age. Can you explain the twin self concept and why you think it's so important?
Well, listen, when I was a kid and I loved Lego, I realized I love creativity, and actually I want to stay a child forever. So that inner child really stayed with me for a very long time. And if you were to ask me today how old I am, I'm probably not more than 15 years of age. And that's where I realized we probably all of us have different ages. We actually have, in my opinion, three ages. We have our real age, so I'm 50. I have my inner age, which is probably, no, let's say 15. And then I have my corporate age. Now, I don't work in a corporate, but if you were to ask a person working in corporations, quite often they're older than the real physical age. So the inner age is really a theory around that we have an age freezing inside ourselves. And what's fascinating is when I talk to men across the world, they typically are substantially younger on the inside. The more they're hammered by bureaucracy, BS, red tape, the older they get, the more they lose the inner child. But the inner child is the naive kid.
He just wants his Legos,
It is the guy who wants the Legos is the 9-year-old kid in Toyota, right? Yeah. Which are challenging things from a naive but pretty common sense point of view. I'm pretty sure, Robert, you are younger on your inside. What's your real age and what's your inner side, Nate?
My real age is 44. Who wants to be older on the inside? I guess I like playing with Legos.
Let me help you here for a second. So a good way to find out what your inner age is for you to tell me when you had a profound moment in your childhood, something happened was really big and it kind of froze your time. Is there anything you've experienced? Right. Remember, my big moment was my Legoland and selling my company, and that was the reason why I was 15, and it froze my time. Did you have a big thing happening?
I had one. It actually, ironically, I think forced me to be older, but I was on a train with my mom, who had just had, my sister was just born. We were coming back and visit my grandparents in Philadelphia, baby, and we were taking this Amtrak train. I was 10 years old, and she told me to go, the trains would stop and it would switch from coal to electric in Connecticut. And she said, go watch them switch the engine up a couple of cars. And so I was very independent kid and I was always wanting to do my own thing. And so I, went up to the front of the train, watched them switch the engine. It was awesome. Started walking back to my mom and the train just ended. So they had actually split the train in half. And this is before cell phone. So I'm headed back to DC. They're going to Boston. Just absolute paranoid, couldn't find a conductor. And I ended up spending the day spending the day in the train station and then taking the train by myself back to Boston that night at 10 o'clock. So that was a very formative experience for me.
Wow. How old were you back then?
10.
10. Well, there's two theories around that. In fact, I met another guy which had a similar thing, but that continued in his life. He was the adult for the family as it broke up, and therefore he was very adult and actually older than his real physical age. But I would assume that actually that is your starting point, that age, and probably you've been affected by things since. So you probably are between the age of 10 and 15 on the inner side. But remember, you have to maintain it, right? It also slips through.
Right. So interesting. Right. So at that time, right, I actually think you're right. I think that forced me to kind of grow up faster in that moment and be more responsible at that time. But you're saying you're sort of frozen in time by those moments?
Quite often you are. And you're frozen because you get an appetite for that change of behavior, and therefore it becomes self-enforcing in your lifestyle. Certainly for me, it became my way of thinking. And I've always said, in the way I innovate, to combine two ordinary things in a new way. But by doing that, you also need to have the courage to find a crazy way of combining things. And that's the inner child doing it. It's not the adult, because the adult will censor you. The adult will say, I can't do that because I'll look like a fool, all this stuff, right? The fact that you are an entrepreneur, you have a company with nearly 200 people, means that you, on one hand, have had the courage, but you also probably had a lesson in how to grow people and basically make sure you maintain people. And that's a really adult role. So you are probably a melting pot of stuff, I could imagine, in your brain, right? But let me give you an advice, and everyone listening. My advice is, the inner child is something you want to maintain. You don't want to lose it. Creativity is not something you have permanently. It's something you have to maintain, just like a muscle. And that means you have to stimulate your creativity. The more you stimulate it, the more creative you become. The less you use your creative muscle, the less creative you become. And that's super important when you are working 24/7 with all your stuff, that you probably less and less are allowing your creative side to connect dots in a new way. We don't think about it, we don't feel it, but at some stage you will sort of realize, my God, those ideas I got once are kind of disappearing.
They're like 80% in the shower, right? And that's why it's no joke. You keep the pad there because that's when you're not engaged and you're just thinking and brainstorming and walking along, and something sort of hits you.
Yeah, and you're so right. So I did call that the water moment. So this is a really good advice to everyone. If you want to find out when you're most creative, and remember, creativity helps you to survive, then write down your day hour by hour, and then write down when you were most creative. Now, what I did was the same as you. I realized I'm most creative when I'm swimming. And I call that the water moment. So in fact, my last book, The Minister of Common Sense, I literally wrote in the pool. I had a pen and a paper in each end. And because I got this, it's almost like a meditation. I really free up my thoughts.
Yeah.
So I realized a lot of people are creative when they're in water, in contact with water. Shower moment, washing up, whatever. Other people when they're running. Some people when they're in the car. And I found out that by mapping down when I'm most creative, and then I started to dial that up. So I killed the number of Zoom calls. I halved it. I said, I want to have more water moments. I want to mix it up more. So I really reshuffled my day around it. I do think a lot of people follow the flow, and they're seduced by the temptation of back-to-back Zoom meetings because they perceive that as being productive, right? The more Zoom calls, the more productive I am, the more I'm fulfilling my duties. That's wrong. You have to ask yourself, when am I really contributing the value? And if I'm just sitting there nodding for the sake of nodding, jump off and put things into perspective and add even more quality at the next session. And that's what I did. That's what you do with your shower moment. But you have to identify those moments, preserve them, protect them, and use them as your source of inspiration.
That's great advice. All right, Martin, last question. This could be singular or repeated. What's a personal or professional mistake you've made that you've learned the most from?
Oh, every day. Every day I'm doing mistakes. I'm only learning from my mistakes, to be honest. I think I'll tell you a story, and I hope I'm not offending anyone with this story, but it comes back to Lego. So in 1994, when the World Wide Web was invented, I knocked on Lego's door and I said to him, hey, let's go online. And we did it, and it was Christmas. In 1994, the 1st of December, we invented the Advent calendar. The Advent calendar was a calendar where people could go in and look at these small lids. You had 24 of them you could open. We were European. Lego is from Denmark. And we were ready to go, and we hammered this out through the emails. And I remember I went to work the 1st of December, 1994, and I had 6,000 emails in my inbox. It was called Quickmail back then with Apple. And I was just blown away. And they were all complaints. How dare Lego have a political view? And how dare Lego, you know, supporting a religion? And you have to remember, I came from Denmark. 99.9% are Protestants. So I never seen other religions. And I never seen people of other skin colors. I mean, I literally was living in a bubble. So I went into panic. I signed up 200 students. They came in, we designed individual emails, and we wrote back to everyone. It was really beautiful. And then I was lazy. I added a signature line, and the signature line would end every email by saying, "We hope you enjoy playing with Lego. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year." And that was the moment I learned, coming from a one point of view, that I was completely wrong. I had no empathy from anyone else. I saw the view from one point of view. And I've learned from that ever since. And that's the reason why I wrote The Minister of Common Sense.
All right. Well, Martin, thank you for spending some time with us today. You're an incredible storyteller, and I'm sure we'll have to have you back. I'm sure there's 100 more stories that we didn't get out of you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. And listen, keep up your amazing work. I love your books. I just want to say that. I don't say that lightly, but I do it when I feel that the views really adding quality to the world, and your writing does. So well done to you too.
Well, thank you. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in to the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Martin and his work, as well as his new book, The Ministry of Common Sense, How to Eliminate Bureaucratic Red Tape, Bad Excuses, and Corporate Bullshit, on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, I'd love if you could leave us a review. And thanks again for your support. And until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.